From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Washington fights to block U.S. soldiers from war crimes prosecution as meetings kick off at the U.N. to set up an international criminal court. The Pentagon, President Clinton, and Republican lawmakers launch attacks on the court. A conversation with the U.S. ambassador on war crimes. Also, a key Senate committee endorses legislation that makes disclosing classified information to the media a felony, punishable up to 3 years in prison. We'll talk to Daniel Ellsberg, the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers, and greater powers for the FBI to spy on international students. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Eight men were awaiting arraignment on charges they took part in attacks on at least 44 women in Central Park in New York following the Puerto Rican Day Parade on Sunday. Six of the men were arrested yesterday, a day after police culled their photos from amateur videotapes of the attacks and made the pictures public. Two more were arrested early today. In all, 10 men have been arrested, including two who were taken into custody minutes after they allegedly attacked three British tourists. One victim was only 14 years old, another a French tourist on her honeymoon. All the attacks occurred in broad daylight. After a crowd ripped away her top and groped her on Sunday afternoon, Ashana Cover says she staggered out of Central Park, found a police officer, and told him what happened. Instead of summoning help, the officer told her to file a report elsewhere. She went to another police officer. He said the same. Ashana Cover and her Howard University roommate were in New York for the parade. They filed notice yesterday of their intent to sue the city over the ordeal, particularly because of police inaction. South Korea's finance minister said today the historic joint declaration signed by the two Koreas this week could lead to government-level cooperation beginning next month. Lee Hun-jae told reporters at the ministry that Seoul plans to resume contacts between government officials on economic matters as a follow-up to an agreement signed by leaders of the two Koreas on Wednesday. Success could mean far greater aid for the impoverished North from the South Korean government, which currently offers modest assistance indirectly. This news from Yugoslavia. An unidentified gunman shot and wounded Serbian opposition leader Vuk Drašković in the Yugoslav Republic of Montenegro. A statement from his Serbian renewal movement in Belgrade called it an assassination attempt. Several volleys were reportedly fired through the window of his house. The statement goes on to say Drašković was hit by two bullets. He was treated in a hospital and later discharged from the hospital at his own request. Drašković's shooting follows a string of mysterious assassinations of officials and underworld figures in Belgrade. Earlier this month, the security advisor to Montenegro's pro-Western president was also gunned down. The Illinois Supreme Court has overturned the sentence of a man on death row since 1982, ruling his attorney failed to present evidence that may have spared his life. The court-appointed attorney, who's now a judge, was so deficient that it probably meant the difference between a prison term and a death sentence for Willie Tompkins, this according to the Illinois Supreme Court. Tompkins was sentenced in 1982 for the deaths of two men 2 years earlier in suburban Chicago. His attorney, Patrick McGann, failed to call as witnesses people who could have described Tompkins as a good son, husband, father, and worker. He delivered food to poor families and repaired toys for needy children during the holidays, and doctors said he was a conscientious paramedic. The court heard none of this. Al Gore and his senior advisors are scheduled to meet in Washington today, one day after a big change at the top of the Gore campaign. Commerce Secretary William Daley is replacing Tony Coelho as chair of Gore's presidential campaign. Gore also plans to meet this weekend with AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, who reportedly had an angry telephone conversation with Gore yesterday about Daley's appointment. Organized labor has long thought of Daley as an enemy because of his championship of free trade deals. A spokesman for the Teamsters calls the Daley appointment a slap in the face of labor. Meanwhile, both Gore and Daley are indicating there will be no major changes in the campaign. Daley says he plans to, quote, execute the game plan that's already in hand, while Gore says the campaign won't miss a beat. The UN Security Council is hoping a two-day meeting of the warring factions in Congo's two-year-old civil war will boost the prospects for peace and cement the withdrawal of Rwandan and Ugandan forces from the northern city of Kisangani. The council is negotiating a French-sponsored draft resolution that would demand the two former allies withdraw immediately from the city, where they exchanged intense fire earlier this month, killing an estimated 300 civilians. But the draft also calls on Rwanda and Uganda and the three other foreign armies fighting in Congo to withdraw from the country as a whole, as called for by a peace agreement signed last year in Lusaka, Zambia, and threatens possible sanctions if they don't. One of Mexico's six presidential candidates formally withdrew from the race yesterday, throwing his support behind the leading opposition candidate. The move by Porfirio Muñoz Ledo came as the campaign continued to heat up ahead of the July 2nd election, with opposition candidates accusing the party that has governed for 71 years of pressuring voters. Most polls show Vicente Fox of the opposition National Action Party, known as the PAN, and Francisco Labastida of the ruling PRI in one of the tightest races in Mexican history. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. We've got a jam-packed show today.
That's right, and we're going to move right to it right now. Key Republican legislators this week introduced a bill barring the United States from virtually ever dealing with a new global criminal court. The legislation would deny American military aid to any country ratifying the International Treaty on the Court. This comes as the Clinton administration is seeking ironclad guarantees from its allies that U.S. soldiers will not be prosecuted for war crimes by the court. The International Criminal Court is expected to set up in about 2 years in The Hague, Netherlands. Some 120 countries approved the court's statutes at a conference in Rome 2 years ago. Since then, 97 have signed the treaty, and 12 countries, including France and Italy, have ratified it. The U.S. was among seven nations, including Iraq and China, that voted against it. We're joined on the phone now by Ambassador David Sheffer, who is the U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you give us the main reasons the U.S. has been opposing the war crimes court?
Well, first, that's the misrepresentation that has perpetuated for 2 years. We are not opposing the permanent International Criminal Court. In fact, we were one of the major negotiators of the Rome Treaty, and we have always stated our position that there should be a permanent International Criminal Court. And it's one of the reasons why we're still so deeply involved in the negotiations that continue in New York on the supplemental documents to the treaty. We just want to get it right, that's all. And what we're trying to do right now, without any proposal whatsoever to amend the Rome Treaty, is to work out a procedure that would enable the United States during those years that we are a non-party to the treaty to be able to work in harmony with the court and also fulfill our responsibilities globally that no other nation in its totality has with respect to international peace and security and the protection of human rights. So what we're trying to do is to ensure that while we are a non-party to the treaty, and that will be for a number of years given the current conditions in Washington, that our armed forces, if they are subject, if any particular member of our armed forces is subject to a request for surrender to the court to stand trial, that we have the right as a non-party to the treaty to consent to or deny that particular procedure. That does not mean that the soldier avoids the rule of law. He's still stuck in some other jurisdiction and will obviously be subject to the rule of law either there or, if circumstances permit, back here in the United States. So that's how narrow the issue is right now, and it really is a false representation to say that the United States is acting in opposition or opposed to this treaty.
But Ambassador, if so many other countries that have agreed to the setup of the court are willing to submit their soldiers to its jurisdiction, why would our government not want to do that?
Because we know that for a number of years, we will not be party to this statute. Now, if you want to understand that, you know, call up the United States Senate. But that's going to be the reality. That's the reality. That's not theory. It's reality. So during those years in which we are not a party to the treaty, we're not talking about our party status here. We're not seeking to change the treaty to change the circumstances if we were a party to the treaty. We're just talking about those years that we are not a party to the treaty. We do not believe it is justified under international law or otherwise to subject our armed forces to a court to which we are not a party to it yet. That is the sole, single, and only issue that is outstanding. And unfortunately, non-governmental organizations and some journalists who are working off two-year-old information continue to think that there's more to it than that. That's it.
In terms of this bill introduced by some Republican legislators, I would assume that the administration is opposed to it. But if you could explain particularly why you would be opposed to it.
Well, we're not reaching any conclusions yet, you know, with respect to our specific posture towards this legislation. After all, we only received it a couple of days ago when it was publicly, you know, announced. We were not consulted in advance regarding the legislation, so this requires more evaluation. But I will say this, that it is a rather counterintuitive piece of legislation, because right now we are seeking to obtain the very provision in the supplemental documents to this treaty that the Senate wants us to try to get. And in order to do that, we have to negotiate. It is counterintuitive to introduce legislation that undermines those negotiations. So all I can say is that, you know, we'll deal with the legislation as the days progress. But right now, we need to achieve the very objective that on a bipartisan basis, both the administration and members of Congress want us to achieve up here.
Ambassador Sheffer, what's to stop war criminals from other countries from moving to the United States so they can enjoy the protections of those living in the United States, say getting a green card, whatever, and saying then they will not be subject to an international criminal court?
Don't ask me questions about the legislation, because I didn't draft it. That's a very
good question.
That's a very good question to ask the drafters of the legislation.
But I'm not talking about the Republicans, because in one sense, in the bigger sense, the Pentagon, the Clinton administration, the Republicans don't disagree that much on this. You all have been a major force in fighting the International Criminal Court.
That's not true. See, that, again, is the misrepresentation. If that were true, why would we be here? We have been here negotiating for the last 2 years, making major contributions to the supplemental documents to this treaty.
Well, aren't you
so
in a...
Why, how could that possibly be interpreted as opposing?
Well, aren't you in an embarrassing position, really, because you have all of these countries that approve the court statutes. 97 have signed the treaty, just France yesterday, I believe, but the U.S. among the very great minority, seven nations, including Iraq and China, to vote against it.
Look, it's not embarrassing to get it right. And oftentimes in these multilateral negotiations, it is the United States that has to basically exercise the courage to get it right. And we don't apologize for that. We have to get this treaty right. And it's, you know, you can look at any of our major allies and their contributions to peacekeeping, and still the numbers of soldiers that they have in exposed positions outside their country pales in comparison to the number of soldiers that the United States has deployed around the world, which which exceeds 200,000.
But we're not just talking about soldiers. Of course, this kind of exemption would also stand for U.S. officials. So when you have U.S. officials providing weapons to notorious human rights abusing regimes, for example, they too would be off limits for the International Criminal Court. But in regular criminal law, might be considered accomplices to murder.
And would always be subject to that under regular criminal law. But if we are party to the treaty, we're not seeking any particular protection as a state party to the treaty. All we're saying is that as a non-party to the treaty, we're in a different category than if we were a party to the treaty. That is all we are saying. So don't extrapolate any theory into state party status when you argue your case.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Ambassador David Sheffer, U.S. Ambassador at Large for War Crimes, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. We made the agreement that Ambassador Sheffer did not want to speak with the opposition to be engaged in a debate, but we are going to turn to them now. Richard Dicker is counsel to Human Rights Watch and the leader of its campaign for the International Criminal Court here in New York. He's at the United Nations, and William Pace is a convener of the NGO Coalition for an International Criminal Court. Richard Dicker, can you explain this point of the U.S. not being a party to the treaty?
Yeah, certainly. But Amy, first I have to say I have a great deal of respect for Ambassador David Sheffer. He has done terrific work in other areas on behalf of international justice, from Rwanda to Sierra Leone to Cambodia. The problem here is that he, but more importantly, the Clinton administration, is dead wrong. What's going on in these negotiations, I believe, is that the U.S. is seeking, as Ambassador Sheffer said, some kind of 100% guarantee that no U.S. national would ever appear before this court. That kind of exemption for Americans is totally contradictory to the principle of equal application of law. And secondly, it is totally contradictory to the practice of international law that the U.S. engages in. Ambassador Sheffer's comment about the non-party status of the U.S., I think, is misleading in the sense that the U.S. government is party to many, many treaties that give courts authority to try citizens from other states that are not party to those treaties. The United States Department of Justice, as a tenet of its anti-terrorism policy, would try a Libyan or a Lebanese citizen for a hijacking offense, regardless of whether Libya or Lebanon has signed that treaty or ratified that treaty. So I think what we are talking about here is an exemption for Americans that is contrary to the notion of law, and I think poses an impossible burden on the many states and certainly NGOs who want the U.S. government to be on board and supportive of this treaty.
Well, Richard Dicker, what about the ambassador's argument that because the United States has far more troops abroad than any other nation, that it's in essence in a special situation?
Well, I think that's a fair point, and I think that is really at the heart of the Pentagon's opposition, which I take to be rooted in the belief that as the world's sole superpower, the U.S. will have to deploy its troops in not multilateral ways, but unilateral ways. For example, an invasion of Panama, again, in the future, I'm referring to the 1989 invasion of Panama, that it would need to do on a unilateral basis, and that it wants protection for acts that other states may not regard as being within international criminal law. I do think that is at the heart of what is driving the Pentagon's opposition to the establishment of this court, or the establishment of a court that would have independence and effectiveness from the permanent members of the Security Council. Let me just, to answer your question, the point is this treaty is loaded with safeguards. Ambassador Schefer has been very successful in obtaining concessions both at the Rome Treaty Conference and here in New York since February of 99, in loading the treaty with safeguards that address those concerns.
Richard Dicker, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Richard Dicker's with Human Rights Watch. When we come back, we'll wrap up the conversation with him and William Pace, a part of the NGO Coalition for an International Criminal Court. Then we'll go to Daniel Ellsberg to find out his reaction to an Intelligence Committee bill that would increase the penalty for government workers who leak information to the press. Finally, we'll have a debate on a terrorism commission series of recommendations that would increase the powers of the FBI and CIA and increase surveillance of foreign students. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. A lot to do today. We'll be talking to Daniel Ellsberg in a minute. But on this issue of the International Criminal Court that is being taken up at the United Nations right now, we have guests Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch, William Pace, convener of the NGO Coalition for an International Criminal Court. How are you dealing with the U.S.'s opposition to the court, William Pace?
Well, the NGO Coalition, which has existed for the last 5 years and now comprises more than 1,000 organizations of global civil society, has taken a position in that it is in principle opposed to the U.S. proposal because it would reopen the Rome Statute, because it is a reversal after 55 years by the United States on a fundamental Nuremberg principle that official acts should never be allowed to be an excuse for individuals committing a war crime or genocide or crimes against humanity. Our efforts will be to continue to work with the overwhelming majority of governments from around the world who agreed that we finally need to have a court to enforce the Geneva Conventions and the Genocide Conventions, both of which the United States has been members of for decades. So these are not new laws that the United States has to agree to. It's just a court that will finally enforce it. It will only enforce it, incidentally, when a nation refuses to deal with it themselves. The United States has a functioning military and civil legal system. So all the United States would have to do if an accusation is made is say, we'll investigate, we'll prosecute. The fact that the United States is saying we don't even want our soldiers to be able to be accused is unacceptable. And it is an effort finally after all these years to try once again for the United States to say we want to be treated differently than everyone else in the world. And that's what the other governments, it's not the non-governmental organizations that are saying no to the United States. It's the other governments in the world that are saying no.
But, Mr. Pace, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Richard Dicker, because what I don't understand about Ambassador Schefer's argument is that this argument that because the United States has so many more soldiers abroad that it's in a special category. Shouldn't the question really be why do we have so many soldiers abroad and why are we involved in so many military actions, especially in a world where there is no major threat to U.S. security looming on the horizon?
Well, I think, of course, that is one of the questions. But I do think it is another form of
xenophobiaism, that the United States is capable of thinking that other countries value the lives of their soldiers less, and you know, France and the United Kingdom and the Netherlands and Australia, all of these countries that also contribute more, they do more peacekeeping than the United States does. They've looked at the statute, and they believe it provides enough safeguards and protections for their militaries.
What does the opposition, the U.S. opposition, actually concretely mean for the establishment of this court? Can it move forward? Is it being established? Does it matter if the U.S. ratifies it or not?
This is unlike the law of the sea, where the United States and other countries were able to stay out and prevent governments from going forward with bringing it into force because they knew it wouldn't work without their support. In this instance, every one of the Americans' chief allies are going forward with it. And therefore, it is our belief that the court not only will enter into force in another 2 to 3 years, but that there will be enough support for it in terms of all of the legal and financial and intelligence and other resources. And I think that is a tremendous threat to the United States.
Regular people who are listening to the show around the country, this is something that's being established at the United Nations. Can they have any say? Can they weigh in? Richard Dicker, what's the most effective thing people can do?
Well, I think the public in this country who cares about stopping genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes that have so horrified people here and around the world over the last few years can weigh in. Certainly with the president can weigh in with their elected representatives and send the message that there is no reason for the United States to stand outside this effort. That would be very important to do at this particular juncture and after this session is over on June 30th. I think what we are anticipating is a situation where the United States, as Bill just said, will be so isolated from all of its closest allies. 17 of the 19 NATO members are well on their way to ratifying this treaty. And at the end of the day, it's unnecessary for the U.S. to stand to the side or possibly oppose this court because it has already received the assurances it had asked for during the Rome Conference and since the Rome Conference.
I want to thank you both for being with us. William Pace, convener of the NGO Coalition for International Criminal Court. Is there a place people can go on the web to get more information? And Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch. I know your website is hrw.org.
ICC Now is the website address for the coalition's
That's ICC Now. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. As we move now to a national issue, alarmed by a torrent of leaks, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has endorsed legislation that for the first time explicitly would make disclosing classified information to the media a felony, punishable by up to 3 years in prison. Committee members, led by Chairman Richard Shelby, the senator Republican from Alabama, says existing statutes do not cover all types of classified information and make prosecutions so difficult that leaks are endangering U.S. intelligence efforts. CIA Director George Tenet, who's complained that the executive branch leaks like a sieve, told Congress in July that he would love to catch a leaker because of the harm that widespread leaking does to the effort of, quote, the men and women of our intelligence community and how it abuses the security of Americans. The bill, however, has generated intense opposition from First Amendment groups, a former espionage prosecutor, and Attorney General Janet Reno, all of whom argue that criminal prosecutions are not necessarily the best way to stop leaks. Well, we'll talk to a legendary leaker. Daniel Ellsberg joins us on the phone right now. He is the man who leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times during the Vietnam War that many say really led to the U.S. ultimately pulling out of Vietnam. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Daniel Ellsberg.
Be here. Thank you.
You were working for the RAND Corporation at the time?
Yes, I was a former official who had left the State Department in 1967 and gone back to the RAND Corporation where I was still a consultant to the executive branch on national security and particularly Vietnam. And the time that I gave the copied and gave the Pentagon Papers, which were in my safe at Rand, to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Senator Fulbright, I was a I was an employee of Rand and a contract employee for the government.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you give your reaction to this bill that the Intelligence Committee has put out that would intensify the penalty, imprison people who leak information to the press?
This effort to get what they describe as the first bill that would make disclosing classified information to the media a crime, the effort to get it, if it fails, will have proven very useful, I think, in revealing to people in the government that there is no such bill now, and never has been. They're led to believe, as I was led to believe when I signed a lot of secrecy promises, contracts, oaths, and so forth, as they do, that there is such a bill that you would be violating and you'd be subjecting yourself to criminal prosecution and penalties, prison, if you gave this information to someone that your boss or the system had not authorized, whether it was the press or a congressperson like Senator Fulbright. I later, of course, gave it to the New York Times and the Post and to 17 other newspapers. That would be a penalty.
By the way, the Pentagon Papers showed that, as Nixon was saying, that we were de-escalating in Vietnam, that they were getting more deeply involved in Vietnam.
Yes, the Pentagon Papers ended in 1968 before, as a history. It's a 7,000-page top-secret history of our involvement from 45 to 68. So it ended before Nixon got into office and started his policy. It showed that all previous presidents, really from Truman on, had lied to the public about what we were doing and what our aims were, what the prospects were, and what the probable costs were. At every step that American democracy had been not just abused, but kind of aborted. There had been no real democracy here because the Congress and the public had never been allowed to discover what we were up to in Indochina, whether it was helping the French reconquer their colony or later taking over the French effort ourselves in dominating South Vietnam.
Well,
but when I was prosecuted, my prosecution for this leak was simply the first prosecution there ever had been. Something this story, I think, doesn't make quite clear that you were quoting from the Washington Post, is that there have been exactly two prosecutions in the history of the United States for leaking to the media, and the reason that mine was the first, and there was one about 10 years later by of a man named Samuel Loring Morrison. Those are the two, and the reason there have only been two criminal prosecutions is that there is no law like the one they propose to put in. But, of course, if people don't realize that, if they think there is such a law that they're subject to, they act in that way, and you don't get as much information as you need, and you should, about what our government is doing, because people are afraid to be sent to prison if they tell.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, there seem to be two especially troubling aspects to this, to me. One is the enormous amount of material that government agencies typically classify. And two is the enormous number of people within the government, including Congress and the political leaders, who engage in leaking process. Because I know that, for instance, a report that we did on the FBI files on Puerto Rico, Luis Free has admitted that there are 1.8 million documents, most of them classified, that he is now releasing, having to do just with the FBI's involvement in Puerto Rico. Could you comment a little bit about this abuse of this notion of classified information by the government?
Well, of course, if you reveal, if you're a government official or you have a clearance and you're looking at classified material, if you release that to someone that your boss, your organization, president, whoever in the executive branch doesn't want told, doesn't want informed, you are certainly subject to administrative penalties. You can lose your job, your clearance. Losing your clearance, you lose essentially your career in that line of work altogether. And these are very strong sanctions. Less than that, you can lose your access to a particular project and lose your influence, lose your chance for promotion. All of these are really very strong sanctions, and they keep most people's mouths shut, even when they realize that this information should belong to the public, needs to be known by Congress or the public, but they aren't going to give up their career or their jobs, and that will always be the case. You can't stop bureaucracies, whether it's frankly probably Pacifica or PSR or whoever, NPR, from enforcing administrative penalties like that on in keeping dirty laundry, keeping the bureaucratic secrets of that organization. The question is whether you want to add to those administrative sanctions criminal sanctions for the first time. And as I say, as these legislators are admitting, there is actually no law now that forbids this. It's not criminal. So the question really is, do you want more information going to the public that is being currently withheld, being currently, quote, protected or stamped classified, or do you want less? The implication of these people is that, like all government officials, they want much less. And as you say, there is a good deal of leaking. There's a great deal. The question is there enough? Do you want more or less? I would say that the price of the secrecy system, one of the prices we've had to pay for the secrecy system as it exists, was our 30-year war in Vietnam. And I'm counting from 1945, really, when we began supporting the French, at least implicitly, until 1975, or the last 10 years which cost 58,000 American lives and several million Vietnamese. That was a very considerable price, and that's not by any means the only price. Ongoing interventions of all kinds have involved deception, and protected. That deception is protected by secrecy, and secrecy is protected by these fear administrative penalties, the threat of firing, loss of access, loss of job, loss of career, and so forth. To add to that, the real prospect of actual prosecutions, not just two, but 10, 100, 1,000, whatever they want, to intimidate people even further into keeping these secrets and reducing the number of leaks, I think would be to give up the prospect of democracy and foreign policy. And the price of that would be great. It wouldn't just, I don't think of that democracy as a luxury. As I say, I think our democracy enabled us finally to end the Vietnam War that our executive branch would have kept going indefinitely.
The Washington Post quotes John Martin, who is supervised the prosecutions of 76 accused spies and won convictions in all but one of those cases, is saying that the bill is vague and probably unconstitutional. He said the biggest leakers are White House aides, cabinet secretaries, generals and admirals, and members of Congress. He said if this were enacted, enforced and upheld by the courts, you could relocate the Capitol from Washington to Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, the site of a federal penitentiary.
That might be good in some respects if we could. I don't know. I'm just thinking of the quality of leadership we've had for a while. But let me take that back. By the way, the people he prosecuted were spies. We do have laws against espionage. Their prosecutions are held all the time. People go to prison all the time for that, and our laws are very adequate. The experiment in my case back in 1971 was to use espionage laws. Without charging me with espionage, by the way, but to use those laws as the basis for a prosecution of a leaker to the media, to the public.
And under this bill, it would be. And so under this bill, though, it would be much easier, and you wouldn't have to be charged with espionage to be prosecuted.
Lord, this bill could almost be called the Ellsberg Act or the We'll Get Ellsberg Next Time Act.
What do you think its chances are of passing? And do you think it's going to have a chilling effect even just being considered?
As I say, if the discussion of it, in like articles like this, reveal to officials who are now in the government that they are not facing a law now, that this law is yet to be passed, that could have a very good effect. People could say, at least some people who would not be willing to go to prison but would be perhaps willing to risk their jobs might be induced to tell us information that they ought to. But that would be good. If the law were passed, of course, you would then at last have this Official Secrets Act of the kind they have in most countries in the world who don't have a First Amendment to the Constitution.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The legendary leaker made the Pentagon Papers available to everyone in this country and around the world. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a quick conversation about what happened in New York this weekend with, it looks like now, more than 44 women sexually attacked as they came out of a big celebration of the Puerto Rican Day Parade. Then we're going to go to a debate on a Terrorism Commission series of recommendations, particularly around the monitoring of foreign students. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, you did your column today in the New York Daily News on what took place over the weekend, specifically on late Sunday afternoon after one of, well, New York's very big events, parades, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, when women who were walking in Central Park, many of them, most of them, Black and Latino, who had been enjoying the parade, were doused with these with water from Super Soaker guns. Those are just the huge water guns. And then had their clothes ripped off and were sexually attacked. The police, in many cases, did not come to their aid, even when they appealed to them. What is your take on this? This is having international implications.
Yeah, well, it's a story that, of course, has been now gone around the world because there were several women that were attacked who were visiting tourists from Europe. And it was a disgusting and horrible series of events that occurred for about an hour period in Central Park. I think that one of the problems that you have is that the Puerto Rican Day Parade is actually probably the largest parade in the country. It's close to 2 million people or more participate in it. And as I noted in my column today, I've been attending the parade since 1969, and I know that in the last few years, the parade has gotten increasingly problematic in terms of the lack of organization and control that the organizers and the police have allowed among the spectators. And in essence, there have been groups of youths that have been sort of descending on the parade now for a few years and engaging in really nasty and overt sexual harassment of women on a regular basis. But the police have pretty much ignored it. The organizers have ignored it. They're so busy making money off the commercializing of the parade, which brings in millions of dollars in revenue to the people who organize it, that they really have not been paying attention to the safety and the well-being of the spectators who come out. And I think that however, at the same time, what's happened in the aftermath of this is that there's enormous racial tension that is developing in New York City, as some of the more we've seen that it was the New York Post, one editorial writer or one columnist started talking about how the barbarians are trying to take over the city again. The New York Observer, a weekly newspaper, came out with an editorial this week talking about that how much longer is New York City going to endure the chaos, the filth, and the garbage that the Puerto Rican Day Parade annually brings to the city. There's been enormous tension in the city for quite a while among upper-class white New Yorkers who do not feel uncomfortable about the fact that so many Latinos come out for this parade and right in the middle of downtown New York. And unfortunately, this attack is being used by some, including some in the media, to let loose some racist and anti-Puerto Rican and anti-Latino venom that's always been below the surface. So I think that on the one hand, many leaders in the Latino community are urging that the people who were involved in these attacks have to be prosecuted. The lack of organization and management of the parade has to be dealt with. But at the same time, these racist attacks and these code words, like the Wolf Pack code word, that continues to be used to denote Black and Latino youth have to be rejected.
And then, of course, the issue of just how the police dealt with this. Many women coming forward saying that they appealed to the police to help them. They could identify their attackers because they were just running out of these crowds of people who had just attacked them, and the police told them to move on or to report to another precinct. And I think this overall goes to the issue of sexual attacks on women not being taken seriously
in
this country.
The police, had the police moved in immediately, this thing would not have gotten out of hand for 20, 30, or 40 women. It would have been just one or two attacks, and they would have been able to deal with it right away.
Well, we're going to move on now to the last issue we'll be taking up today. A report released this week by the National Commission on Terrorism says that the U.S. should be more aggressive against terrorism. The report calls for greater surveillance of international students and greater power for the CIA and the FBI. The commission was created 2 years ago by Congress following the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The panel consists of former government officials and private experts. Some of the commission's recommendations include the tracking of international students in the U.S., allowing the FBI to sift through evidence gathered in criminal cases and pass useful information to the CIA and other intelligence agencies, and allowing the U.S. military to lead any response to a terrorist attack as opposed to the FBI or FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We're joined on the line now by Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and L. Paul Bremer, chair of the National and Commission and former State Department Ambassador at Large for Counterterrorism. L. Paul Bremer, can you elaborate on these recommendations?
Yes, I certainly can, because you've got two of them wrong. First of all, in case of monitoring foreign students, we didn't call for any new program. What we called for was a continuation of a program that's been in place since 1965, which requires all American universities and colleges to report on all foreign students, irrespective of their nationality. That program's been in place now for 35 years, and basically what we called for was computerizing it, putting it on computers, which is something that is called for by a law passed by Congress in 1996. So just to set the record straight, there's nothing new in that recommendation other than computerizing the system. We did not call, as you suggested, for the military to lead any response to terrorist incidents. What we said was that it is possible to imagine catastrophic terrorist attacks in the United States. We're talking here in terms of not hundreds, but tens of thousands of casualties, in which the president would want to, might want to have the option of calling on the civilian leadership of DOD, using probably federalized National Guard forces to bring to bear DOD's command and control and superior logistics. And all we called for was...
And that's, of course, the Department of Defense.
I'm sorry?
That's just DOD.
Yeah, Department of Defense. What we suggested was that the way to be sure that in such a circumstance where you have tens of thousands of casualties, the way to be sure that civil liberties are not impinged on is to plan ahead, to have contingency planning in place. And we used the example of what happened after Pearl Harbor, when two of America's great 20th century liberals, Franklin Roosevelt and Earl Warren, locked up Japanese Americans as an example of the kind of infringement of civil liberties which can happen after a catastrophe if you haven't thought about it ahead of time.
But Mr. Bremer, doesn't the government now have the ability to bring in, for instance, I think of the riots of the 1960s when National Guard and even Army troops were called in. Doesn't the government already have the ability to call in the military in cases of a major national emergencies?
Yes, they do. We're not arguing the question whether they have the ability. What we are saying is there are no contingency plans being drawn up. And we suggest that a contingency plan should be drawn up and exercised so that in the event, which we all obviously hope never happens, that you had a catastrophic terrorist attack, people have thought it through, have exercised it, and know what to do.
Well, we're also joined by Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, on the phone from Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Could you respond to Paul Bremer's comments?
Absolutely. I mean, Ambassador Bremer, having chaired this commission, which has released this truly hideous and absolutely disturbing report, one of the most frightening documents to have emanated from the government in many years in this country, a truly serious threat to the civil liberties of all Americans, in my view, has been soft-selling the recommendations. But it's very clear, if you read the report, that this report suggests all kinds of new things. For example, right now not only is there no system for tracking all foreign students in the United States. This would be something new. It's not true that it wouldn't be something new. Also, the commission suggests that student academic interest become part of the monitoring. In other words, that what a student studies should be a tip-off that there's something wrong, and in other words, that they should be investigated. The report clearly says that this system, the CPRIS, would record a foreign student's change in major from English literature to nuclear physics, as if that's something sinister, as if that's something that the government should legitimately investigate. And I really think that what the report fails to take into consideration in any serious way is that the government and the law enforcement in this country should be investigating crime, criminal behavior, and criminal conspiracy, and should not be investigating anybody's lawful First Amendment protected political, religious, or academic pursuits, and stigmatizing and investigating students because of their academic interests, or even, frankly, keeping a database, a coordinated database on their academic interests, is truly a frightening and prospect, and it certainly would not help the United States protect itself from terrorist acts. But what it would do is set up a giant program to identify international scientists at an early age and monitor them. As far as the DOD thing goes, again, this is an absolutely unprecedented use of the military for domestic law enforcement and disaster management. It's a complete violation of the principle of the separation of the military from domestic law enforcement, and really an awful idea, which I'm glad to say has been rejected pretty much across the board by almost everyone who's been commenting on it, because it's a major threat to the civil liberties of citizens. The Army is not equipped to respect the rule of law. Soldiers are not trained, oriented, or in any way ready to do that. And, of course, the report doesn't define a catastrophic event. And let me just say, it also says the Army could take charge of domestic law enforcement before a catastrophic event. So really what this report is envisaging is the creation of a very large national security state apparatus in the hands of the federal government that would greatly damage the rights of citizens. And in response to what? I mean, Louis Free in February 1999 told the Senate that since the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, no single act of foreign-directed terrorism has occurred on American soil. And so in this context, in the context of no foreign-directed terrorist act having occurred since February 1999, we're proposing to radically damage civil liberty protections and, frankly, key elements of the constitutional rights of Americans.
Ambassador Bremer.
I respond. First of all, Mr. Ibish, I have all respect for your committee, and I sympathize with its objectives, but your facts are wrong on the student thing. You're just plain wrong. Since 1965, the law has required exactly what I said it requires, which is reporting, including on students' areas of activity of studies. There's nothing new in that. That's been in effect since 1965. If you object to that law, that's fine. But you you have every right to petition your congressman to change the law if you wish. But that has been the law since 1965. And all we're suggesting is that as the Congress mandated in 1996. That system should be computerized. Again, you can object to the computerization if you wish to, but there is virtually nothing new in what we are suggesting. Those are the facts. Now, on the DOD, it is not the case that we have suggested that DOD could take any action before an event. And I'll quote you from the report, the circumstance we're talking about, because I think it's important to be precise here. We said, and I'm quoting from the report, in extraordinary circumstances, when a catastrophe is beyond the capabilities of local, state, and other federal agency, or is directly related to an armed conflict overseas, the president may want to designate the Department of Defense as lead federal agency, may want to designate him. And indeed, you made the point that the Army is not trained for this kind of a circumstance. That's precisely our point. Our point is that if the president, in such a circumstances, wanted to ask the Pentagon, under its civilian leadership, to take the lead, for example, using federalized National Guard troops, that is the kind of contingency that should be planned for and exercised ahead of time, precisely to avoid the kind of impingement of civil liberties which you and I are rightly concerned about.
Well, let me quote you from the report, page 40. The Department of Defense, if necessary, should, what it says here, contingency plans that would transfer lead federal agency authority to the Department of Defense, if necessary, during a catastrophic terrorist attack or prior to an imminent attack. So, in fact, there is a call for the Department of Defense, possibly under certain undefined circumstances, to take control of domestic law enforcement and disaster management prior to an attack, and that is in your report.
Yes,
and my facts are absolutely
accurate
on this
purpose,
on this regard.
And our objective in making that recommendation is precisely to be sure that when such an event happens, and I am under no doubt, and I think nobody, no American should be under any doubt, if we had a major terrorist attack which had tens of thousands of casualties, the pressures on the political leadership of this country to act and act decisively would be essentially insurmountable. And if you have not thought about that ahead of time, the risk is that much greater that the civil liberties that you and I are talking about will be impinged on, as indeed they were after Pearl Harbor.
If I can ask a question for a second,
Hussein, Ambassador Bremer, one thing that occurs to me is most of the terrorist attacks that have occurred in this country, certainly over the last few decades, have been perpetrated by Americans. Is there any envisioning? I mean, not just Oklahoma City, but we've had numerous examples over the decades that it's terrorism attacks from within our own country. Are you envisioning the increased surveillance of all Americans as a result of the fact that there have been so many terrorist attacks within our own country?
No, let me just remind you that the mandate of our commission by law was to investigate international terrorism, not domestic terrorism. Our report talks about international terrorism. Terrorism conducted against the United States abroad or terrorism conducted within the United States by non-Americans.
And why is the focus limited to that, considering the major threat is here at home?
Ma'am, you'd have to ask Congress. I mean, I just operate under the law. That's what the law said.
The law said, and
I think in your setup piece, you mentioned that the commission was established in the wake of the bombings of the embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam.
We only have a few seconds, so I want to ask, where does it go from here? You've made your recommendations. Now what happens?
Well, now it is up to the executive branch and Congress to act on the recommendations. We have some 37 recommendations in here, and it will be up to them to act on them.
If people want to see the report, where can they go?
They can address themselves to the National Commission on Terrorism.
Can they go to a website?
Yes, they can. I don't have the website.
We'll put it on our website. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've come to the end of the show. Ambassador Bremer and Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. You can go to their website at adc.org. That does it for today's program. Again, we are looking for people who remember first hearing the song sung by Billie Holiday, Strange Fruit. And if you remember your experience, please give us a call at 212-209-2999. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!